This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Hayden Ramparat, and I'm here with
Jean-François Robitaille.
And both of us are postdocs here at the Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. And for the last 2 days, we were hosts to the UK SETI Research Network. And today we have our special guest, and we're very delighted to have Stephen Baxter with us. Who's a famous sci-fi author, and so...
Yeah, I guess the first question is, can you talk to us about your background and how you became or chose to be an accomplished science sci-fi author?
Well, it was a childhood dream, I suppose. My first sensible ambition after wanting to be an astronaut and so on. Age 12 or 13, I was a big science fiction reader and got into science fiction in the first place through TV and the movies, Star Trek, you know. And I read a collection by Isaac Asimov. And in there, he described how he wrote each story when he was a teenager, working in his father's pharmacy shop, as I recall, and sending stories into magazines, you know, and gradually building up. And it was the first time, I'd never met a writer, you know, it was the first time I realized that writing was a career you could start, anybody could start from. You could start anywhere and get into it that way. So I was writing stories at an early age, 14 or 15. Okay. I had a teacher at school who wrote radio plays as a sideline. This is in Liverpool, by the way, so I grew up not far from here, where we're speaking now. So he got me into professional habits by the age of about 16, finishing the stories properly and sending them to be sold. It took me a long time to build up any sales momentum. So I was following other careers. Science fiction really got me to science and mathematics, and so that was my academic career. Ended up with a PhD in engineering. But I wasn't an academic, you know, the academic, with all respect, it wasn't for me. You know, after the PhD part, you know, chasing endless contracts. So I went into industry for a while. I worked as a teacher in a sixth form college. I think that's a typical writer's career. You kind of bounce around looking for, while all the time developing my writing career on the side. So I finally gave up my other jobs, 1995, so late 30s by then. I published 6 or 7 novels and they were. But really, basically starting from school age.
So you said that you've attended the UK SETI Research Network. You've been to all. Yeah. So what's the importance of sci-fi author? I guess if you say you're no longer academic or you don't identify as an academic, what's the importance of attending these type of meetings? Is it for like ideas or to motivate others? Or?
Well, a bit of both, really, I'd say. Occasionally I get invited to attend meetings like this just as a sort of guest speaker. And that's what happened in the first place. 9 years ago now, 2008, Paul Davies, the physicist, is now the head of a committee to do with SETI called the Post-Detection Task Group. They look at societal implications of a detection of a radio signal from ETI or even direct contact with ETI. How would we handle it? What would the cultural implications be and so on? So I went along as a guest speaker to that. And I found that this group has been going for a long time, since the 60s, I think, but... And there's usually been science fiction writers associated with it. You know, it's clearly within that domain. And so I volunteered to join at the meeting, that committee. So that got me into the SETI world. And for me, it's not quite so much generating ideas. It's just becoming informed with this stuff. Mm-hmm. And also feeding back, you know, some of the more constructive speculation about the alien has been in the pages of science fiction novels, all the way back to H.G. Wells. So it's being part of the conversation, really, I think. So I write my books, but I've done some academic papers on SETI and SETI aspects as well. Kind of fringe stuff, you might say. One, for example, was I was working on another project to do with an interstellar space probe using modern technology-ish. A fusion probe to Alpha Centauri. And one thing that struck me there was, what if the probe achieved contact? Suppose you have something like an Iron Age civilization that we can't see from here, can't signal to us. But there it is, and the planet, the probe's orbiting the planet, and it's clearly discernible from structures and so forth. What should the protocols be? Should it make contact? How should we equip it? What should it do? And I think actually it seems to me that we're going to have to decide that before we send such probes out. So that's academic, you see, but it's fringe speculation.
Prepare a question that is, I think you already answered, but if you think you have other answers, you can go ahead.
Okay.
So. Yeah, so it's like we said before the recording, it's the first time I've been to a city conference before. And what was surprising is the amount of talks that are not necessarily discussing about the way we can detect life, intelligence life out there, or how we can understand the signal, but like the anticipation, like you just said about what will happen if we are contacted by someone else. So what do you think is the role of the sci-fi literature in this kind of anticipation context?
Yeah, I think it's adding to the imaginative scope of the speculation in a way. But I think that's changed with time, not my time with SETI, but since the beginning of the Enterprise in 1960. I'm not sure if the founders of SETI would admit this now, mm-hmm. but I think they expected to get result quite soon.
Okay.
Not immediately, but say within 10 years or 20 years. I think they really expected to find something, and of course they didn't. And you can rationalize that away. Now we're 50 years into SETI. 1960, 50 years from then on is 2010, isn't it? So we're in the sixth decade of SETI. Still, we found nothing. So I think the speculation now is evolving somewhat, because on the other hand, we've now got the exoplanets, all that data on it. I think one stat that was quoted at this meeting was that probably one in five stars has a planet in a habitable zone. So we're Earth-like life with liquid water. Could conceivably arise. That's a heck of a lot of, hundreds of billions then of potential habitats for life. Why is that? Why? So that it becomes more difficult to understand the silence. So I think the speculations about what's going on out there have changed because of this lack of evidence. Mm-hmm. The absence of evidence at some point becomes evidence of absence. You can never prove. You could pick up a signal tomorrow, which would throw all that away.
Yeah.
But in fact, now there are ingenious speculations about why we're not being seen. And I think I go along with Ian Crawford, an astronomer who's at the meeting today, and you'll have heard him say, to give him credit, that the most likely explanation seems to be either there's no intelligence at all, at least willing to signal for whatever reason, or the zoo hypothesis, which is where, like Star Trek, the Prime Directive, you stay back until you think the junior culture is ready for contact. Mm-hmm. They're hiding in some way. Because it's not just radio signals and so forth that you'd see noisy civilizations. Starships are pretty energetic craft, You'd see an antimatter starship from light years away, like the one in Avatar going to Alpha Centauri. You'd see it from light years away, this moving point. Probably if you had warp drive, massive, it would be like a neutron star being shoved along at somewhere close to the speed of light or beyond. These are pretty energetic events. It could be we're seeing those and not recognizing them. Mm. Gamma ray bursts might be starships, exhausts. But it does seem mysterious that as far out as we look, distant galaxies, you see no sign of modification on a large scale. So as far out as we look right across the observable universe, there's no sign of modification of that kind. It's pretty mysterious. So actually the zoo hypothesis, the idea that we're living in a kind of planetarium, well, it's filtered out, is plausible and it fits the facts. Or for some reason, nobody does this. Nobody makes a splash on a cosmically visible scale. But that seems strange as well. You'd only need one and you'd see it. The astronomers now are just another thing that came up in this meeting, short-term radio bursts. The radio telescopes are discriminating enough now to pick up these things. We didn't know they existed 10 years ago. So those are like SETI events, like short-term bursts of radio energy. Now we're finding those, and yet we haven't found SETI. So the more the technology evolves and the more time goes on, the more the deeper the search gets, the more strange it becomes. And so I think in a way, science fiction can help by coming up with wacky scenarios to explain this stuff. Like the zoo hypothesis, really, I think was an SF idea before it became, I don't want to say academicized, but it became more formalized in academic papers. On the other hand, some of the more rigorous thinkers about this stuff follow a very science fiction-like logic. There was one paper here by Duncan Forgan, academic from Scotland, who was talking about how you would use transiting planets to signal to each other. Mm-hmm. So if somebody at Alpha Centauri sees the Earth transit the Sun, you could fire a laser beam from the middle of the shadow, or you could put a huge structure in orbit so you get peculiar observable transits of the star, that kind of thing. And if you But then if you're an SF writer, you take that as a beginning idea and then go on from there. And that's what Duncan Forgan did. He said, well, okay, you could have a whole network of these people, these civilizations speaking to each other. You can do statistics on the number of stars you could reach and so forth. So I think they borrow a kind of science fictional logic as well. You take an idea and then push it as far as you can, which is H.G. Wells' basic technique. Pick some idea and then push it as far as you can and make a story out of it.
Yeah, that kind of led into a kind of approach. One of the questions I always wanted to ask a science fiction writer is, like, for instance, like back in like from H.G. Wells' time, like, sci-fi motivated a lot of science. We had the cell phone because somebody essentially wanted to have the Star Trek communicator. And then you actually see translators, like, you know, similar people are developing, trying to have and even the tricorders.
Yeah.
And there's loads of it. Like, I got into to astronomy because SETI was a big thing. I also wanted to find out more about life out there.
Yeah.
Star Trek was a huge, huge influence. Reading the books of Isaac Asimov and yourself motivated like a lot of generations. But now that we're reaching science, it's reaching those science fiction. It's getting close to those. Like we see Starshot, Breakthrough Starshot is aiming to do that same thing what you talked about in sending a probe to Alpha Centauri. So now that we're getting so close, that science is really like, if you draw a curve, that they're kind of merging. What does that mean for sci-fi for the future? Does it have to like really up its game and really go forward or take the current ideas? And I think you just mentioned it as well, and just jump forward and just keep pushing science.
Oh, well, I think basically you keep pushing science, yeah. Mm. I think that it's always felt like that, that reality is catching up with the science fiction. So H.G. Wells, mechanized warfare, it took till it was the Second World War, was more like his pre-First World War vision.
Yeah.
Of populations in flight from a mechanized foe. Then the lunar landing, I do remember 1969, there was a lot of discussion then about, is that the end of science fiction then? Well, it was the end of a certain kind of science fiction. You know, there's always further horizons. And besides, the cultural assumptions change a lot. So if you're writing a book now about the colonization of the solar system over the next two centuries, it will probably look and feel quite differently from how it would have looked in 1940 or 50, because we're much more aware now of conservation issues and climate problems and resource depletion and so forth. And, you know, you can look out to a kind of an exponential expansion beyond the Earth, and pretty soon you've used up all the asteroids, all the moons and so forth, and you're facing the same kind of dilemmas as we face now. So you can have you could look at the same time scale, but with different assumptions. So the story always moves on. And I think for each generation, to be honest, it seems to me what they respond to, it subtly changes as well. Science fiction is really all about the fears and dreams of the present in which it's written. And depending on what you can write anything, you know, but I go for hard SF, which is as plausible as possible within the laws of physics. Even so, you're selecting from a tree of possible futures. But the possible future you'd select is always conditioned in a way by what you're writing from now. For instance, in my Zeely novels, I've been working on those. My first published story was in the Zeely universe, 30 years ago now. And I keep on going back to this because I think it's pretty good discipline for me personally. That was my original influences, you know, all coming together. So going back to that is like going back to the well again. But about 20 years ago, I was thinking about the nearish future. So the Zeeliot's interstellar future. What's the nearest future, the next few thousand years? And I came up with this vision of the Earth, as I would like to see it, by the year 4000, as it from space it looks natural again. You know, maybe there's a couple of cities dotted around, but it looks natural. The forests are back, the animals are back. But it's a very high-tech civilization living very discreetly off the natural energy flows of the planet, which must be possible with efficient enough technology, as little damage as possible is done to the place. You disturb the energy flows and mass flows as little as possible, restore some of the lost animals and so forth. Low-ish population, say a billion, you know, it still seems plenty of people to me. That's not a bad vision, but the question is how you get there from here, which is quite different from... So that's a 1990s vision. The 1940s vision of the Earth was more like, is it Coruscant in Star Wars, where it's entirely plated over with a huge city? That seemed like utopia back then, but now we know that's, you know, nightmare.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Imagining not a dystopian universe, but then something that is environmental. So that's very good. So coming back to this city research, your talk today was, if I do not mistake, mostly about the... what would be the intentions of an alien coming on Earth? And I don't know if you want to discuss about, is it's your last book?
My most recent book, it's called The Massacre of Mankind, and it's a sequel to H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. So, you know, at the end of the novel, the Martians die off because they weren't prepared for the bacteria in Earth's atmosphere. But in my novel, they come back again 15 years later and have another try, more prepared and more systematic. But they have to come. It's a climate collapse on Mars. This is the old Lowell picture of Mars and a cooling sun. We now know the sun's heating up, so we'll have to move for other reasons in the future. But they come to the Earth, it's warmer, you know. They've been struggling with this situation for a million years, according to Wells. And so back they come. But my talk today for the SETI group was really about how the public react to fictional aliens, which is the nearest thing we've had to contact with the alien after all. And in particular, Wells's and my Martians, because when you do a book launch, I did some bits on the radio and the telly, but I went around bookshops around the country, London up to Edinburgh, giving talks about the book and so on, and reading bits. And I found people were very interested in the Martians and the development of the Martians in my book, because everyone thinks they know about Wells's Martians, you know, the fighting machines and everything. The way you think you know Superman and Doctor Who and Mr. Spock and a small handful of other aliens that have survived in popular culture. So I'm quite interested in that. And I think with the Martians in particular, because they have this logical story, they're not conquistadors or imperialists in that way. They are migrants. They have to come again. So you can sympathize with that. And they do, on their own level, the moral, they help each other when they fall in battle, that kind of thing. Well, they got this fatal flaw which we share. Anybody lower than them in the pecking order, they got no sympathy for. They're using us as livestock. Well, that's their ambition anyway. Just as we do, you know, like the chimps and so on. So, however, and it's fiction, you know. No Martian actually blew up my grandfather in the year 1900. I'd probably hold a grudge. You can separate out that reality in a sense, and you can understand why they're here. So, even though you may not welcome them, and you'd resist them and so forth, you can have a certain compassion for them because they're driven to this desperate extent. And in Wells's novel, going to the other end of the story, the beginning of the story, the cylinders land in southern England and they smash everything up, just the landing, set fire to the heath, you know. But the first reaction of the local people is to try and help the beings inside. They know nothing about them, but they try and help. They think the cylinder might be stuck closed. They're going to burn up in there. So they try to save them, and then they try to signal to them in a way with white flags, you know. So the impulse is to signal and communicate and help. And so I was quite struck by the public response to all this as I was discussing it. You know, it seems to me that we do have the capability, at least in theory, of comprehending these alien beasts and seeing beyond their immediate actions, the destructiveness and so on. See, why are they actually here? Why we should be equipped with mental muscles to recognize the alien and sympathize with it is another question. It could be that it's just our habit of projecting personality onto everything, onto gadgets and pets, and so on. Just as in the past, you know, early physical theories were about how a falling ball wants to move down towards the earth and so forth. Or animism, these even earlier theories of the universe. It's better than no theory at all. But so it could be a kind of flaw in a way, or it could be a strength, because we did. One of my pet theories about the alien is that we evolved among aliens, other kinds of hominid running around the planet. I don't know what the current estimate is, but many kinds as we evolved, all of which we pushed away in the end and outcompeted. But you know, you go over the hill and you'd find another kind of people over there. Not just strangers, but a different kind of human with different ways of thinking and so forth. So maybe we're equipped to expect a landscape like that. And now it's depopulated, really, except for the chimps, which is quite remote from us, really. So maybe that's why we dream of aliens and used to dream of angels and demons and ghosts and so forth. It's because there's a gap in our perceptual universe.
So coming to H.G. Wells' novel, when the aliens came, you said that, well, and the humans show compassion to the Martians and stuff. If you had written not now, say the first contact now happened, do you think the response would be the same given the current climate of the world right now?
That's a very difficult question. A book like Wells's has survived because it's got many levels of meaning. And his initial inspiration was about colonialism. There was a horrific story of the British wiping out the Tasmanians off the coast of Australia completely in a few generations. Terrible. And you know, history is full of these awful colonial crimes. And that one specifically inspired Wells to write something about, well, if someone fell down from the sky and did the same to us, we could hardly complain. However, it has got these other levels of meaning. Yeah. So there's the mechanized warfare that worked out in through the 20th century. And now the climate migrant thing is, you know, that's clearly going to be a big aspect. It's a big aspect of the present. It's going to be a big aspect of the future. And that's what we can maybe take away from now. So I suspect if Wells was writing it now, then possibly he would play up that side. He would say, look how we're turning away these boat people. You know, it would serve us right if we tried to move to Mars and they turned us away. See, I think you'd have the same kind of extrapolation.
Okay, mm. So coming back to the meeting that we had this week.
Yeah.
So as someone who's written for like a couple of decades now, especially about traveling and finding aliens and essentially in quote unquote SETI type things.
Yeah.
And seeing it happening now and being part of a community that's actually actively involved in it, and then we've seen breakthroughs actually meant to jumpstart that. What's your thoughts on the general, how it's going about now?
The SETI enterprise. Yeah. It's clearly something that's always evolved as negative results have come in. Kind of as I said before, did you know that there was a prize given towards the end of the 19th century for detecting evidence of life beyond Earth? Mm-hmm. And they disqualified Mars. They thought that as soon as they had a radio receiver big enough, that then, you know, they would hear radio signals from Mars. They just assumed. So you couldn't win the prize by detecting life on Mars. So that one fell over, you know, and we found that the solar system was more barren than we might have hoped in terms of our kind of life, at least. And as I said, the early SETI experimenters, I'm pretty sure, thought they'd find something soon. So it's evolving. It's looking for other kinds of SETI evidence, fitting these new hypotheses. I think one interesting one is looking for evidence of life in the past. Suppose intelligent life is evanescent. You know, you collapse because you run out of resources, and you may survive, but you're no longer signaling to the stars. Seems quite possible. So there's talk now looking for evidence of, well, artifacts left on the moon, let's say, a probe left by an alien. Or even more convincing in a way is just exotic products in interstellar dust. Exhaust from starships, basically. Find some titanium in moon dust or something like that. It's something that couldn't have got there by any natural process. That's something that could have been drifting around the galaxy for a billion years, and yet it would still show up now, evidence of something in the past. Quite convincing and compelling threads to follow. However, I do have private theories, possibly most of the academics do as well, but they could never admit it, because they'd never get funded again. That maybe we're just missing it, you know. Maybe quasars or industrial catastrophes at the beginning of the beginning of the universe. Maybe there was a gigantic explosion in the middle of the galaxy. It was 100,000 years ago, something like that. It was a big molecular ring of molecular dust being wafting out from the black hole. Maybe that was evidence of a war. It is in one of my novels, you know. So you have to assume that it's natural causes. And you have to prove extraordinary claims and need extraordinary evidence. So you start with that, and you work down a scale of these things before you get to the artifact hypothesis. But it could be that some of what we're seeing out there is actually artifacts. Maybe something quite subtle as well. Suppose there was a colonization wave that's sweeping across the galaxy, consuming something like, I don't know, nitrogen. You look one way, you see a nitrogen depletion, you look the other way, there's no nitrogen depletion on certain exoplanets, let's say. How can that be? Well, because the colonizing wave got that far and it's moving on, or it's stopped. So there may be subtle things like that. We come up with theories about formation of planets in different parts of the galaxy, wouldn't we, and so forth. But it may be that kind of thing as well, strange depletions, is evidence of resource consumption in the past. So it could be, frankly, that the evidence is right under our noses, we're just not seeing it in the right way.
Yeah. New point of view are always welcome.
I have one more question, if you have any more.
No, that's fine.
So, okay, well, one last question from my point of view. As someone who's like dabbling slightly in sci-fi, on evenings I would think of these things, because, I mean, reading lots of sci-fi and then actually doing science, like I'm involved in SETI and a lot of other things like SK and stuff.
Yeah.
I tend to think about some of these things as well. Like, But for a general listener, like, who's interested in, like, what advice you would give to, like, if they want to, like, get involved in writing sci-fi, or at least putting on your own story, even just on paper, for themselves to read?
Oh, well, basic advice is just to do it. Just write. It's, I think in some ways it's more difficult now because there are distractions, online media stuff. And if you pitch a novel to a publisher, they will say, what kind of online presence have you got? Because they can use that to advertise. So there's a real danger that you get distracted by your Twitter feed as opposed to the novel you're supposed to be writing. It's a solitary, patient thing where you have to manage your own time. You'll know, but it's like writing papers or a thesis even. You've got to do it yourself in the end. You get feedback from other people, but you've got to manage your own time in long chunks. And that's not going to change. So personally, I would avoid workshops and courses. Because that's not what writing is, you know. You don't sit there working with other people. Well, I know you do on some collaborative projects, screenwriting and so on. But if you're writing a novel, it's just you alone. I'd recommend doing a correspondence course if you want to do something to develop the writing, where you can get these things now where you, and I did one 30 years ago, where on short story writing, you get like a monthly exercise, which maybe writing fragments in a certain style, or maybe writing a short story on a certain topic. But you're actually writing, you're doing the job in the way that you'll have to do in the future. Then you get feedback from that's my basic advice, is just to write. And, you know, you will be expected to sort of promote yourself through Twitter feeds and stuff, but that's not the job. You've got to just write and do it. In my day, there was the same kind of questions would be asked, you know, well, what have you done? What interesting things have you done in the past that we can now promote? And the most interesting thing I ever came up with was applying to be an astronaut. And I did, actually. Yeah, when this is about 25 years ago, the Mir was hosting guest cosmonauts, and they wanted one from Britain. And there was an open application. Anyone could apply. So I did. And I got through several stages. I was the right age, I had a science background. You'd have to do some basic science up there. But I didn't have a foreign language. Any foreign language would have done. But I got through several stages, you know, and I wish I'd lied about it. You know, maybe got to Star City. I'm not sure if I would have been brave enough to do the physical stuff in the end, but. So, you know, but at least that's an anecdote you can put on a press release.
Yeah. I think that's it. Thanks a lot, Stephen, for your time. It was enjoyable, and it's a great pleasure to have a chat with you.
Good. Thank you.
I think that's it.